This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll start with an overview of recent congressional votes and some upcoming Supreme Court cases. Our own Michael Ratner will talk about habeas corpus, electronic surveillance, votes on a recent New York Times ad, and more.
If we thought this country was going to get better when the Democrats controlled Congress, we were dead wrong. The war continues, there's still no writ of habeas corpus for Guantanamo detainees, and now electronic surveillance has been authorized by a Congress that the Democrats control. It's a sad, sad time in America.
We'll talk with noted law professor and criminal defense attorney Michael Tiger about a recent essay in the Monthly Review.
Tiger draws some amazing comparisons in this essay. He talks about how enemy combatants under this administration is a category that was used when slaves were denied personhood in a case called Dred Scott. Remarkable interview.
Marking the 40th anniversary of the murder of revolutionary Che Guevara, we'll talk with Tito Gerassi, who knew Che.
An incredible set of reminiscences. Tito Gerassi not only knew Che personally, but tells us that he was poisoned by the CIA while dining with Fidel.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Our own Michael Ratner is just back from several weeks of travel and work abroad. Michael, it's great to have you back in the studio. And we have a lot to report on in terms of updates with the Supreme Court, Congress. Unfortunately, none of it is terribly positive, but can you start by giving us a rundown on congressional updates?
The question, Heidi, you know, in this country right now is what do you do when you have an executive who's essentially a thug, a Congress that's craven and lays down, and a Supreme Court filled with right-wingers? And the problem for all of us who were humanitarians, civil libertarians, people who want to protect human rights, is what do you do when all three branches of government are essentially on the same page, and that page is essentially off the page of human rights? I don't know if you have any thoughts, Heidi, and then we'll talk about Congress.
Well, that's absolutely right. Our whole system of checks and balances that has been so precious for so long seems to have disappeared pretty quickly, too. But that said, what's happening? Things are moving slowly on a lot of civil liberties fronts, unfortunately.
Slowly. I could the question is, will my children see the end of the war in Iraq? And they're very young. So it's pretty depressing, really. But I want to look at just really three votes that have taken place in Congress in the last month or so. And they really make you feel incredibly disappointed and sad for this country and for the victims of its policies. The first was obviously, as people have followed, I think, pretty closely, the Iraq War vote. There are many different votes on the Iraq War, 56 votes on one of the amendments to either maybe the Webb Amendment, which was going to shorten people's stays in Iraq, soldiers, or one to end the war by or start withdrawing troops by summer of 2009. I think the Democrats and a few Republicans got 56 votes. And then what they didn't do, and this is really where the Democrats are weak-kneed, they didn't push it. 56 is obviously a majority. They could have passed the legislation, but or tried to pass it. What they said they were afraid of was a filibuster. Now, it takes 40 votes to cut off a filibuster. In other words, the Republicans could have just started to talk, and the Democrats said, we need 60 votes to cut off a filibuster, and they don't have the 60 votes because they had 56 votes. But the Democrats, rather than pushing the Iraq issue and saying, we're passing legislation to get some kind of withdrawal from Iraq or something from Iraq, They just died. And they said, we're not going to float it. What that did is essentially let the Republicans off the hook. Had they gone through with the legislation, the Republicans would have been forced to filibuster, and they would have been seen as the people obstructing
Why?
It.
Why didn't they push for this?
Other than the fact that Democrats play softball compared to the Republicans who play hardball. You know, this was never an issue when the Republicans were there. When the Democrats said, we'll filibuster, when the Republicans ran the Congress, you know what the Republicans' reaction was? We're going to change the law. We're going to change the way Congress runs, and we're going to make it so you can't filibuster anymore. And so that was the Republicans' reaction. But the Democrats, instead of saying, we're going to force you to filibuster on the Iraq war and it's your problem, they just basically caved. So we're here with the Iraq war for a very, very long time, I'm afraid, as we probably know. But that was just one of the votes. The other vote, similar to the war, really, was on habeas corpus. As our listeners know, we talk about habeas corpus a lot here because the Center for Constitutional Rights represents, you know, many Guantanamo detainees, coordinates all the cases, and that's the right that's been stripped by the Congress twice under Republicans in the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commission Act. So we've been working for months, really, maybe a year, with heavy lobbying, all these hundreds of lawyers from big firms, and we're getting close. And we thought we actually had it very close. Again, we got 56, I think, approximately, within one or two of that, 56 votes in the Senate to restore habeas corpus to the people at Guantanamo. Once again, the Democrats folded. They said the Republicans said they would filibuster this, and we don't have the votes, 60 votes, to overcome the filibuster, and therefore that we're going to fold. So again, the exact same situation. Why shouldn't the Democrats have put the Republicans on record as saying, we will filibuster? Let the Republicans be the ones who really stop and publicly stop really any kind of progressive change.
The Democrats are tiptoeing around, it seems. Now, who are there any chances? Who might have been of the Democrats people that should have voted the other way?
Key one was Lieberman, obviously. Yeah. You know, he's not really a Democrat anymore. So I think they had 49 votes or so, and then they picked up five or six Republicans, which gave them the 56. They lost the one Democrat and so-called Democrat, and then they picked up a half a dozen Republicans.
What's happening in terms of the Center for Constitutional Rights on habeas? Where are we in terms of litigation?
Oh, actually, that's a good lead into that issue. We've been to the Supreme Court twice already on restoration of habeas. Twice the Supreme Court has said we have that right, at least according to federal statute. And so now we're in the Supreme Court for the third time. When I say we, I mean the center and a lot of other Guantanamo attorneys. For the third time, asking whether the Constitution gives the writ of habeas corpus to people. And that case, people at Guantanamo, and that case will be heard on December 5th, roughly December 5th, in the Supreme Court of the United States.
But the other times that you were before the Supreme Court, it was a different Supreme Court in terms of members.
That's correct. The first time we won 6-3, that was the Razul case. That was when O'Connor was on the court. Rehnquist was on the court also, but Rehnquist was substituted by one of the conservatives and O'Connor by another, so we now have Alito and Roberts. Rehnquist was always gone, so we basically lost one vote. So the most we could win this case by is 5-4. It's unclear to me whether we're going to pick up the five votes. We have Stevens and Kennedy in the middle. They both voted with us in Razul, but of course that's before Congress said we don't want people to have the writ of habeas corpus. But of course now it's a constitutional issue. We don't know what they're going to say. I'm hopeful that we'll win it. If we don't, and as we've been saying really since almost a few weeks after 9/11, it's the end of democracy
right.
in America.
Right.
Because if you don't have a writ of habeas corpus, you can just pick up anyone anywhere in the world and leave them out in an offshore penal colony and never get to see them. So those are two issues that we've really had serious defeats in Congress, and the Democrats, sadly to say, did not stand up. On the third issue where we had a defeat is this issue of warrantless electronic surveillance. As people are aware, the president asserted the authority to electronically surveil people, even U.S. citizens in the United States, without going to a minimal protection, a secret special court that was set up a number of years ago. What we call the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The president violated that law in a wholesale fashion for the last few years. Congress did nothing. They haven't had a serious hearing about it. Even the Democrats, nothing. They still haven't had a hearing. And what happens? The president comes to Congress for more authority now to essentially to be able to do what he was doing illegally. Basically, the Democrats, 80-some of them in the House, and of course the Senate, gave him that authority to engage in warrantless wiretapping against American citizens. The other votes, at least the Democrats, we had 55, right. 56 people. This one, 80-some Democrats join with the Republicans, I believe, to actually give us a law that now allows warrantless surveillance of American citizens. Now, they did, as they usually do to make themselves feel better, they put in a sunset provision. What's that, Heidi?
A sunset provision means that in a certain period of time, we'll revert back to the way it was before.
Right. This is a six-month sunset provision. Have you ever known of a statute that actually a sunset provision, that the statute ever sunset?
No.
I don't think it has. The Patriot Act had a sunset provision, right. A two-year thing or three-year, right. I don't remember. And, of course, as the sun got nearer to the horizon setting, Congress stood up and said, well, the sun's sinking too fast.
Right.
Let's raise it up in the sky some more and let's not at sunset. So this one, I mean, we're in deep trouble.
I'm trying to figure out, though, Michael, the rationale for these Democrats. Is it that they want to appear to be concerned about national security and that the warrantless surveillance can be justified in their minds as, well, these are different times, we have to look out, you know, do whatever is necessary?
Warrantless surveillance was completely disgusting. That was, you had Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, saying we need this to be able to track down terrorists. You should understand, this law that we opposed, this law allows you to do this without a warrant. All that the civil libertarians wanted was that the government should go to a secret court and get a warrant before they wiretap the Heidis and the Michaels and the Center for Constitutional Rights. A minimal, really, right. minimal procedural protection. So the question I have is, it's completely irrational that you need a warrantless wiretapping to go after terrorists, alleged terrorists, particularly because there is an emergency provision. If you need to wiretap someone, you have 3 days to do it, or you did that long, right. and then you can go to the court afterwards. Right. So the whole thing is ridiculous, and Dianne Feinstein was completely ridiculous. I mean, really outrageous to say that you need this, and all we were asking for is a minimal protection. So I think that the reason the Democrats on that one is they don't want to be seen as weak on terrorism. If you go to habeas, it's probably likewise. They don't want to be seen as weak on terrorism and the Guantanamo detainees, even though they've been proven to be, you know, the wrong people. They still want it to appear that, you know, they're not going to be weak on terrorism. The war, of course, is more complicated. The most cynical of people say that the Democrats don't want to vote to actually do anything about the war, in part because when they want the Republicans to lose the election based on the war. Mm. Of course, I don't see why a filibuster wouldn't have done that same thing by the Republicans, but I actually think on some way it's a cynical political maneuver that Nancy Pelosi and others and Reid and the Senate Majority Leader, Pelosi, of course, in the House, have basically made a calculation that Democrats can win and they can win the presidency if things remain approximately the same around the war.
The status quo.
And meanwhile, Iraqis are dying every day and American soldiers are dying every day. So that's Congress. This is a brief update. I think, Heidi, why don't you talk a little bit about the Supreme Court. We mentioned the December 5th argument in Guantanamo, but they are now going to review two other important decisions, at least one of which we've covered on this program.
Right. They're going to review the issue of whether lethal injection for capital punishment is cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, because we've had cases, many cases, and we've talked about them here on Law and Disorder, where the person who is being injected suffered a great deal of pain and for a pretty long period of time. I don't think the court is going to rule in our favor on this, Michael.
It is hard to believe. You know, there's 38 states that allow the death penalty. There's 38 states that do lethal injection. Clearly causes a lot of pain. It's a three-shot regime with like a painkiller. But I agree with you. I would be shocked because how are 38 states going to kill people?
Exactly.
You know, the last time they ruled on a method of killing someone, I think it was 1883. Question was it cruel and unusual punishment to kill people or to give them the death penalty by firing squad?
Oh, right. The other case that is coming before the Supreme Court is the issue of whether identification, formal state identification, is required at voting polls around the country. And the issues that the Republicans are saying this raises are it will eliminate voter fraud to have everyone bring identification. Civil libertarians and others are saying that a lot of people who the Republicans think would probably vote Democrat may be elderly, poor, and may not have the required kinds of forms of identification.
There's
needed.
Really only two types, right? I mean, what else is
state
there?
State driver's identification.
Driver's license and passports, right? What
and
else
passports.
Is there? This is a way of people who don't have driver's license, who take public transportation, can't afford cars, or for other reasons don't drive, or because they're elderly.
And that's a lot of people.
And not that many. And what do you think the percentage of this country has passports? Is it 10%? Is it 20? It's in that range. So you're talking about a lot of people being disenfranchised.
But I'm not feeling happy about how this is going to be voted on either.
No, I don't either. And of course, this is all attempts by the Republicans to try and slant the election.
Michael, there was another congressional vote that we should mention, and that involves the recent advertisement in the New York Times by MoveOn.com.
Yes, I remember seeing the ad, and I know there's people who have tactical problems with it, but I was pleasantly surprised to see MoveOn take a position that was really aggressive and strong on the war.
And have a full-page ad in the Times.
Right, and the ad said Petraeus, and then it said Betrayus,
right?
You know, like Petraeus betrayed us, essentially. And of course, it was referring not only to his current testimony, a whitewash of the war, but prior testimony when he talked about military victory and all this and things going better. And I thought it was great because I think in this situation, this is a time that calls for measures that are very, very severe and harsh against this war.
Right.
But there was a huge outcry about this ad. Is my right, Heidi?
Well, I just read a couple of days ago in the Times that apparently MoveOn.org got a discounted rate. It's called the standby rate, where you don't know exactly what day your ad's going to appear, and so you pay significantly less to the Times. And these ads cost over $100,000 for a full-page ad.
Well, that came about, that revelation, because the right wing and Giuliani, I think, put an ad in basically going after MoveOn.org for that ad because everybody thinks it's demeaning the military and how can you do that? And
of course, unpatriotic.
Unpatriotic. But all I think about is Westmoreland, who maybe our listeners remember, was the general who kept selling us Vietnam. And that's how we wound up with 500,000 troops and 50,000 dead Americans and 2 million dead Vietnamese. So Westmoreland and Petraeus is a nice comparison.
Yeah.
So, and I think it was an appropriate thing to go after Petraeus. But Giuliani and everybody else went crazy on the Republican side. They forced the Times to basically say, we made a mistake here because normally the rate for a ad, what's called a standby ad, is $65,000. And that's what they paid, even though they had said, can we have the ad on a Monday in the front section?
And it ran that day.
And it did run that day. And generally that cost double that, $130,000 or something. And then what was interesting, as a background to this, when MoveOn first got attacked, they were pretty strong. And they went out to their list and they said, we need to raise money. And they raised $500,000.
Right.
What happened? They
paid up the rest to the New York Times,
which they didn't have to. They certainly didn't have to. And so here they were, strong in an ad, strong on raising the money. And for all of you listeners who might have given money to MoveOn.org, if there are any, some of your money has now been used to pay the New York Times more money for that ad.
Yeah.
We just went through the war in Congress, habeas in Congress, and electronic surveillance in Congress. And what they really can gather up their forces for is to condemn an ad that says something negative about a general who is leading an illegal killing war in Iraq. It's just off the wall to me.
Stranger than fiction.
It is stranger than fiction. You couldn't think this stuff up. But let's end this little segment with Petraeus betrayed us all.
Mm.
And so did Bush.
Yes. In his recent essay titled, The System of Wholesale Denial of Rights, published in the Monthly Review, law professor Michael Tiger looks at the implications for civil liberties and human rights in this country, such as a system whereby the president can lock up anyone he chooses and never have to explain why to a court. Tiger draws significant historic parallels, among them the Dred Scott case. Michael Tiger is a research professor of law at Washington College of Law at the American University in Washington, D.C., where he teaches federal courts, international human rights, and criminal law. Tiger has argued 7 cases in front of the United States Supreme Court. He's represented several controversial clients since then, such as Angela Davis, Lynn Stewart, Terry Nichols, and members of the Chicago 7. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, Michael, you just came out with an important article in Monthly Review. It's in the September 2007 volume called A System of Wholesale Denial of Rights. And in that article, you address an issue that's very dear to me as one of the Guantanamo lawyers about the use of the term and the legal reasoning of the term enemy combatant. So why don't you give our listeners a little sense of What's that about? What is enemy combatant? What's the article really trying to say that's been, that I think is somewhat different than others have been saying?
Well, those who invented the term enemy combatant and the term alien enemy combatant were aware, as every lawyer should be, of the norms against torture, the norms against extraordinary rendition, and the Geneva Convention. So they stole a chapter, stole a phrase, an idea from those who were pro-slavery and in favor of the suppression of Native Americans. They said, tell you what, why don't we invent a term that does not exist in international law and constitutional law? And therefore, instead of prisoner, instead of defendant, instead of person, we will create a category called enemy combatant.
And we're talking about the current administration, yes, in the post-9/11 situation.
The Bush administration post-9/11. They invent this term, and they say, since that term does not appear anywhere in the literature, these people must, by definition, not have any rights under the accepted principles of international law and constitutional law.
Now, that's clearly been their argument, obviously, in every court we've been in with them.
That's right.
And that means they're denied access to our courts.
Right.
They fall under the military regime.
So I started thinking about this. Where have we seen this before? And we saw it at two significant points in American history. And the first was the Dred Scott case.
This was my amazing part of the article, I have to tell you, Michael. But go ahead. I mean, tell us about what's the Dred Scott case and why is it applicable?
The Dred Scott case was the case in which the Supreme Court majority held that a black man has no rights that a white man is required to recognize. The Dred Scott case was a test case. Frederick Douglass and some of the other anti-slavery people thought that it might be possible to make an argument that slavery so violated the norms of the Constitution that it had to be illegal everywhere. But at the very least, someone such as Dred Scott, who had been in free territory, should have the right of habeas corpus recognized so that he could argue in court for his freedom.
I didn't realize it was a habeas case?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Okay, but keep going.
That is to say, therefore, this case is brought. The argument made, the various arguments made, and this comes to a head in 1857. Now, that's very important because Justice Greer assured President-elect Buchanan that the court was going to resolve the slavery issue and the Dred Scott would solve it and we'd never have any more problems with slavery anymore. And Buchanan then believed that and said it in his inaugural address. He also exercised a great deal of influence to see if they could get a northern justice or two to join the court's majority, because it really would look bad if the only votes were from the southern justices. And so they held that Dred Scott has no right to petition for his freedom in federal court under any circumstances.
Now, how is that going to resolve the slavery problem? I don't understand that part.
Well, I don't understand the way that George Bush thinks that enemy combatant distinction is going to help resolve the terrorism problem. I mean, it's nuts, because the Dred Scott case made the Civil War inevitable.
So you mean to say that what Justice Greer was saying to Buchanan was, don't worry about this, because by the time we finish with slaves, they're not going to be people, essentially.
That's right. We're going to make slaves non-people, and since they won't exist and they won't have any rights that can be enforced in courts, then and everybody will see that we're self-evidently right when we say that, then under our constitutional system, the problem will be solved.
Can you draw the parallel out a little bit with enemy combatants and then give us your next historical example?
Well, yeah. So the enemy combatant is the same thing. You know, the theory of the Bush administration is, if we invade your country and shoot you, you're what's known as dead. That's the technical word for that. But if you shoot back, you're an enemy combatant. And we say, no, wait a minute. If you're on the field of battle, even if you're not wearing a uniform and provided you're not using disproportional force, you're a defender. You have the right to shoot back. Bush said, no, but that's for people in the different categories, says the Bush administration. And we call them enemy combatants, and therefore they have none of these Geneva Convention rights.
Right, and that's why in the Military Commission Act, the Congress, you know, basically did what the president wanted and said, alien enemy combatants have no right of habeas, which is essentially the same thing as they're all Dred Scotts.
Right. Well, not only do they have no right of habeas, but then we take it further. They have no right to any of the protections that are provided for prisoners of war.
Correct.
They have, if and the offenses they commit, even though they are defined word for word in the same terms as offenses in Title 18, the Federal Criminal Code, they're not entitled to a jury trial or any of the other protections of people who would ordinarily be, you know, be tried for violation of the criminal laws.
Right. That's what's going on with all these military commissions. Yes. And the fact that it's taken them 6 years and they still haven't had a trial, because essentially they're doing a form of trial that, if you want to even call it a trial, that's completely outside of any law that
we
know.
There's another historical example that's not an American one. You remember Field Marshal Keitel, who was a Nuremberg defendant.
Yes, of course.
Had written in his own hand that the Russian prisoners of war were not entitled to prisoners of war status. So he was hanged for that.
Right. He basically said that Geneva Conventions don't apply to them and we don't have to apply them, I guess.
That's right.
Well, to sort of summarize where we are, essentially you've said that by creating a new category, as the Bush administration has done, they've invoked characterization to take any question out of the public debate scheme.
That's right. They've invoked characterization to remove people from the forum, the ambit, within which you have to recognize folks' rights.
And Michael, you also in the article talk about some more recent antecedents for enemy combatant. And you actually go back to Clinton and material support, and you talk a bit about Lynn Stewart, and I know you were the trial lawyer in Lynn's case. So can you talk about how some more recent, like sort of the, I guess it was leading up to this term, and how our judicial system in our country got softened up a bit, it seems to me.
Sure. Within recent memory, we have, of course, the Japanese relocation, which defined a whole group of people in a way that permitted us to round them up and intern them for a whole number of years. The McCarthy period provides another example. I mean, characterization of someone as not entitled to claim justice is a tactic of repressive governments.
And Michael, you know, we've talked about this on Law and Disorder recently, the use of the term terrorist against, say, Earth activists, animal rights activists. It sort of brings it to a higher level where they're so vilified that often the juries in such trials are swayed by emotion from the term terrorist. So it's happening on a number of different levels,
sure.
I think.
Let me give you the other historical example, because I think it's that's fun. You know, the Cherokee Nation of Native Americans decided that in order to have its rights recognized, given the incursion by white settlers, that it would organize itself into a real government, that it would have a constitution, that it would be the Cherokee Nation. And so it organized itself as the Cherokee Nation and brought suit in federal court against Georgia to have its rights recognized. And Chief Justice Marshall in Cherokee Nation versus Georgia said, oh my goodness, no, these subject peoples, these subhumans can't be a nation, and therefore they can't come to federal court to enforce their rights. They simply, we look in Article 3 and we go down the list of various people, Article 3 of the Constitution, that are entitled to sue in federal courts, and by golly, we just don't find subject peoples in there. And having classified them as subject people, well, then Georgia gets to do to them almost anything it wants.
Michael, do you have any optimism on this issue at all? I mean, you know, I've been here for 6 years at the center litigating, you know, the Guantanamo cases. We're going back to the Supreme Court again. But we're really, in many ways, nowhere after 6 years on this issue. In some ways, you know, the Democrats, Republicans, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, do you think that with historical time that we'll look back and this is an outrageous time, or do you think we may have crossed the divide that we may not be able to remedy?
I certainly don't believe that we've crossed a divide that we would not be able to remedy. The questions are how and when. Not in this administration. And I don't see that any of the candidates for the Democratic nomination are being particularly courageous, nor do I see Congress being particularly courageous. The United States exists in the world at this moment, not just in the process of doing all of these unfair things to people that are within its custody, but in systematically killing tens of thousands of people in Iraq and engaged in an aggressive war in Afghanistan. This is one of these circumstances in which accountability may be slow to arrive, but it will arrive in the context of the international community.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually right.
What we're doing here is holding out the standards. Not only are they doing this bad stuff, but they know better. There's a written constitution that says that they know better. And then there are these precious few Article III judges who are standing up and saying something about it. I mean, the fact that Judge Alex Kaczynski, perhaps the most conservative member of the Ninth Circuit, should have dissented in that Afshari case, talking about the unfairness of the foreign terrorist organization characterization of that Iranian organization, you know, that gives you some reason to...
Yeah. Now, we're getting some of that, and of course, we're getting some federal judge saying, you know, well, torture is okay if they're terrorists, you know. So you're getting it from both sides.
I'd like to read a sentence or two from the end of your article, Michael. You say that, as Roland Barthes has written, the system that calls itself justice is always ready to judge you as you must be and not as you are, as a social construct and not as a human being. But when the system behaves in these ways, one has at least the opportunity to compare its performance with the state's own proclaimed standards and to have the benefits of publicity and courtroom confrontation. And that's a theme that I know you share, and we've talked about on Law and Disorder, the importance of raising these issues in the public eye in conjunction with this kind of important litigation. Now more than ever, I think, with actions that we're seeing the government use, we have to keep shouting out about what's happening with a strong people's movement as well as litigation.
Oh, exactly. I mean, one of the things that we learned in the civil rights struggles was that after Brown versus the Board, there were sure a hell of a lot of lawsuits going on in the South, and there were some judges doing right and some judges doing wrong. But not until February 1st, 1960, when the sit-in movement began in Greensboro, North Carolina, and then ignited that series of protests across the country, did we begin to make serious progress on those issues. The job of lawyers is not to stand at the center of all the events by which the world is moved. It would be arrogant of us to think that we could do that. Even if we're as good as you all are and as the Center for Constitutional Rights is. But rather, we play our role, and the only way we can play it is if we're associated with a movement of people who are demanding change.
And we're talking with Michael Tiger, the author of a recent article in Monthly Review, A System of Wholesale Denial of Rights, and he really addresses the issue of enemy combatants, Dred Scott, Japanese internment, and the relation among them all. Michael, I know you've written a number of different articles and books. And of course, one of your early ones was Law and the Rise of Capitalism, which was great. I think you wrote that 20 years ago. But I know you have a new book out. And can you tell our listeners the name of it and how to get it, et cetera?
Yes. It's called Thinking About Terrorism, The Threat to Civil Liberties in Times of National Emergency. And in the book, I try to trace first the history of state-sponsored terrorism, because a nation state can do a lot more and they'll keep doing it. And then non-state terrorism, and in the context of state-sponsored terrorism, to remind people about some of the events of which we've been talking and will talk here, and then dealing with terrorism to show in the non-state context, to take historical examples and show how powerful nations, generally colonial powers, have misused the terrorist term to characterize liberation movements and to exercise violence against them.
Can you say the name of the book again, Michael?
Thinking About Terrorism.
It's available everywhere, Amazon, et cetera.
Well, it's certainly available on Amazon.com.
Well, thank you again, Michael Tiger.
It's been an honor, Michael.
An honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Don't be afraid, and don't be led by the media. We, the people, are supposed to dictate foreign policy. Right now, our government is keeping us out of foreign policy. That is a direct infringement of our rights. Don't just sit around and let them think for us. Be strong. Be strong. Be aware. Wake up. We have the power. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, It lingered near in the form of shining valleys where the pure air recognized and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed the people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
On October 8th, 1967, Che Guevara was captured in Bolivia by Bolivian rangers. He was taken to a small town, Higuera, and on October 9th, he was murdered by people claimed Bolivians, but in fact, they were people working for the United States CIA who had orders to murder Che. We mark the 40th anniversary of Che's murder in Bolivia. As many of our listeners know, Che has become the icon for revolutionary struggle. He was selfless, one of the heroes of the Cuban Revolution, but he was not willing to rest and stay in Cuba. He went on around the world to try and bring revolutionary progress to other countries, from the Congo to Bolivia to other places in the world. So today we remember Che Guevara. We remember him particularly by talking to someone who knew Che Guevara, John Tito Gerasi. Tito Gerasi, as I call him, currently teaches at Queens College at the City University of New York. Tito was born in France in 1931, the author of numerous books, including one called Venceremos, which is the collected works of Che Guevara. And we're really pleased to have with us today Tito Gerasi, who will talk to us about some of his personal reminiscences of Che, as well as what he thinks of Che's revolutionary thought. Tito, welcome to Law and Disorder. And we really want to talk to you about the 40th anniversary of Che's murder, which took place in Bolivia in 1967. Right. And I know you were familiar with Che, and I think we'd like to talk to you about some of your own reminiscences, as well as what you consider positive, negative, whatever, about Che's thinking and work. So first of all, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to know Che.
Well, at the time, I was still part of the establishment insofar as I was working for the New York Times as a correspondent. And I was asked to cover with two others, Tad Schultz and Juan de Onís, who were above me, to cover the Punta del Este conference at which the United States presented the Alliance for Progress plan.
What year was that, Tito?
1961.
Okay, so you were asked to cover that conference.
So in order to get rid of me, Juan de Onís said, go cover Che. Because he figured that Che wouldn't talk to him or to Tad Schultz. The cover means really cover, so I moved into this really awful fleabag hotel because that's where Che was, whereas they all went to the fancy four-star hotels where Dillon, the American representative at the conference, was staying and all the other big shots. And I couldn't get close to Che. Every time I tried, he said, I don't talk to the imperialist press.
I love it. Tito, that's great.
There he was with a whole bunch of people who turned out to be great friends of mine eventually, but this big circular table, and I was sitting by myself in the corner, looking at them at every meal and hoping to overhear something. And then all of a sudden arrived a correspondent for La Prensa, García Lupo, Rogelio García Lupo, who was a friend of mine, who had written a book on La Revolución de the Revolution of the Generals in Argentina. He was a sort of weird combination of right-wing nationalist, but he had been in Tacuara, which was a right-wing nationalist movement in which Che was a member in their student days. And so he goes up to Che, he's a great friend of Che's, about to sit down, and turns around, sees me, and says, Che Boss, what are you doing in the corner over there? And Che says, you know him? I said, yeah, very well, but he works for the Imperialist Press. And Rogelio said, well, I work for La Prensa, that's worse than the New York Times, right? he called me over, and I joined him. Actually, he put me right next to him, between Rogelio and himself. It was absolutely fascinating. Eventually, he asked all those presents. Everybody was a correspondent of some kind, or a writer or something, also activist, to be at my disposal if I want to write a book about my experiences in Latin America. And so I did. Eventually, I wrote an article called Alliance for Regress, which I sent to friends of mine that had started a magazine that went bankrupt before it was published.
I presume that was a critique of the Alliance for Progress, which was the U.S. way of attempting to deal with revolution in Latin America, right?
That's right. Right. And eventually, one of the guys who wanted to make that new magazine, when it folded, gave it to Peter Rittner, who was then managing editor of Macmillan. And Macmillan and I ended up getting a telegram out of the blue, which had, please answer by prepaid cable the following three questions. Can you have just read your Alliance for Regress article? Can you write 85,000 words or more on the subject? Two, how much money do you need to go to each country to give an I was there feel? And three, who the hell are you? That turned out to be The Great Fear in Latin America, which...
it's a great book. I recommend it to our listeners, The Great Fear in Latin America. It's one of... Tito has a number of books, but that's one I really liked.
Yeah, it's unfortunately a little bit dated in most of the chronological sections, but in any case... And also my prediction...
And that was at the behest of Che, right? That was where those three questions
were.
Well,
yeah, from. So Che right. Then said to everybody at the table, since he's going to work on a book, you help him. You show him what the gringos never see. It included Porquera, who was Allende's press secretary. It included Oliveira, who was his press attaché. It included Salomón Corvalán, who was killed eventually, but who was head of the Socialist Party of Chile. It included lots of Argentines and included a couple of Brazilians and so on. So, they really did help me. Every country that I went to, I called them up, and sure enough, they were at my disposal, and they showed me what the regular gringos, as Che said, never saw.
I know, Che, as we know, was murdered in 67. In between that time, I know you probably got to know Che even better. Is there any incident that stands out in your relationship with Che during that period?
I went back to Cuba various times, and one time it was an anniversary, the 7th of July, of the Algerian Revolution. And I was there, so I was invited by Ben Bella, who happened to be there and whom I knew. And Che showed up. So I tried to ask Che a couple of questions, and he kept saying, I don't talk to the imperialist press, but with a wink, because he didn't want to talk to anybody else. And then as he was about to leave, he had an aide come to me and says, Che's leaving, would like you to join him. So I left with Che. And I ended up going to his house, which was outside of Havana, where Martha was and so on. And we talked for a long time, unfortunately always off record. He said, you're still a correspondent, you're still writing, so I have to say it's off record all the time. There are a couple of things that he told me, which I eventually put into my book, Venceremos, which was the complete works of Che Guevara that I had that I translated and edited. One of them, which I didn't put in, was that he considered the Soviet Union as counter-revolutionary. They don't want revolution, he said. And he asked me not to put that in, but it was something that he had brooded about. And it was just before he went and gave that famous speech of his in Algeria.
Right, I remember that speech. That's when he actually publicly condemned the socialist bloc, really, right?
Right. And, and other things, I remember once when he was a minister of the economy in Cuba, the famous joke, I asked him if it was true, and he just laughed. He never answered.
Tell it. I've heard it, but I've never heard it from someone who actually really knows more about it than I do. It's a great joke.
Should I tell you?
Yes, tell
absolutely.
Us.
Well, it was, when Fidel got all the comandantes together, and he asked, who was this, who was this, Fowler Chaumont got the... education and so on, they were all made ministers. And finally, Fidel says, well, who here's economist? And Che raised his hand. And so Fidel said, okay, you're minister of the economy. And when everybody left, Che with a real puzzled look hung on behind, and he said, why did you make me minister of the economy? He said, well, I asked, who here is an economist? And you raised your hand. And she said, oh, I thought you said who here is a communist.
I remembered it something like, I guess my Spanish is terrible, buen comunista, like a good communist.
Right.
And then he raised his hand, hearing the word economist. What was your reaction? Where were you when you heard of Che's murder?
Well, I had just begun teaching at San Francisco State. I was quickly accused afterwards of having been in Bolivia and having betrayed Che. All sorts of things like that were said.
I didn't know that at all. You were in Bolivia during the period?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was just accused of all those things, okay. Right?
And accused of betraying him how?
Telling where he was, I presume.
Right, really. Yeah. It did come out that I was supposed to go and join Che, but as a newsman, after Debray came out.
Right, Debray was accused of that, ultimately.
Right, and so I went to Cuba for training, because the Cubans said, this was Jose Vieira, who had been in third political attaché in New York, but who in fact was an intelligence agent. He had arranged for me to go and join, but he said, but you've got to train because the Bolivians and the American Rangers are going to treat you as a guerrilla, so you've got to be in tip-top shape. So the whole summer before that, I was in training in Cuba.
I love it. I didn't know that, Tito.
You recently remarked that when you were a journalist for Newsweek in the early 60s, you were poisoned by the CIA while dining with Fidel.
What happened is that there were seven of us, six Latinos and I, who had lunch with Fidel. We were served shrimp salad. And Fidel talked and talked and talked, and he kept digging into his plate, but he didn't put anything in his mouth. It kept dropping off, and eventually we all finished our shrimp salad. And the waiter came, and Fidel saw that all the plates were empty, so he said, oh, okay, take it away. So he never had any. Well, all of us ended up in the hospital.
Really?
Oh, my God.
I ended up going blind first, and then...
No, I didn't know that.
God.
Yeah,
oh.
And then almost choking to death and then passing out. The driver that I had, who was a Gusano,
anti-Fidel, yeah.
Said, the last word I heard, intoxicación, obviously rushed me to the hospital. We all came to, and so on, et cetera. And years later, during the church hearing, I found out that it was published that Rosselli had been contracted by Giancana for the CIA to go and murder Fidel. And one of the things that he said that they did at the one of the methods that they used was to give Fidel the little red book, which made everybody laugh as if Fidel would sit down and read the little red book.
Tell our reader, that's the Mao slogans and sayings from China.
Right, and putting cyanide on the corner so that the paper's very thin so that he'd have to lick his finger
to
and
turn.
Keep licking his lip to turn the pages. And the other thing was that they had managed to get rotten shrimps for a dinner that he had with seven members of the Latin American press. But I keep good files, so the seven members turned out to be six members and me.
Amazing.
Wow.
And I asked Lenny, by the way, Lenny Weinglass, a very good friend of mine, if he could sue the CIA for it. But at the time, the CIA was denying it so that I would have to find who gave the orders to Giancana, who was by then gunned down, as was Rosselli.
Okay, Tito, amazing story. I didn't know it was actually confirmed in that way. You know, you did publish the book Venceremos, which is Che's writings. You published a book called The New International, which again was about really that period and what the hopes were for a new world order. You know, the little bit I ever knew about Che's writing had to do a lot with the foci theory and guerrilla war. And how has Che's theories held up? What do you think of them? I mean,
the problem in Bolivia, specifically to work backwards, was that he didn't trust Moncre and the Bolivian Communist Party. And Moncre said, I'm the head of the Communist Party. I've got the arms, I've got the money, I've got the logistic support. I'm going to be head of this operation. And Che said, no way. And so they broke relations. And Moncre, in fact, did not give any support. Any of the stuff that came through from Cuba did not give it to Che. So Che was really very, very much handicapped. despite the fact that some of the leading communists, like the Paredes in Tien, his brother, ended up fighting with Che. You know, it was a kind of tough kind of thing. But the last time I saw him, which was during Olas, or was it Ospal, it was 1965, he had just come back.
Wait, tell our listeners what Ospal is.
Oh, the Organization of Revolutionaries All Over the World, you know. And OLAS was revolutionary, the Organization of Latin American Revolutionaries. Right. It came out of the non-allied movement, which was held in Havana. The second one was held in Havana in 1965. And Che was then there, and so I went to see him. I had dinner with him and Martha and a couple of aides there and so on, and we started talking, and somebody slipped and made a reference to the Congo. I put two and two together very quickly, and I said, so that's where you've been all this time. You've been actually in the Congo. And he said, well, nobody's supposed to know about that. You know, so it's a complete secret, right? So forget about that. But I said, well, what was it? He said, it was an absolute disaster. I mean, this superstitious people there that call themselves a revolutionary, but they don't want to bury a dead on if there's a full moon. They don't want all sorts of problems that make it very, very difficult to operate in the wild. I presume that a little bit of that carried over to Bolivia as well. You know, he was very depressed, and I asked him what he's going to do next, and he said, I'm going to leave. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I cannot. Actually, at one point we went to the bathroom and he said, I can't stand being idle. I'm actually impotent because I'm not fighting.
You know, what do you think of at least the theory that backed both Cuba, the Congo, as well as Bolivia, was that, you know, a small band of armed revolutionaries could essentially light a fire in an insurrectionary right. situation yeah. and begin a revolution, which was the Cuba model, which Che then tried, I guess, in the Congo and Bolivia. As a theory of revolutionary change, do you have any thoughts about it?
Yeah, it only works if the objective conditions for revolution exist. Right? The Foucault creates the subjective conditions, but all the subjective conditions in the world aren't going to make a revolution unless the objective conditions were. And in Cuba, the objective conditions existed. In Bolivia, when I was there and I went around talking to peasants and so on, They were miserable. They were unhappy, but they kept saying, you know, we now have the land titles. The MNR, the National Revolutionary Movement of 1952, which brought Paces Fansoro to power, and then betrayed, became friends of America, and betrayed, brought back the big business and all that. But nevertheless, in 52, gave titles to the land to the peasants. The peasants were then saying, you know, at least, you know, this way my children are going to get the land, and it's going to be legal.
Well, that's really very helpful, Tito. About the murder of Che, I mean, there's always been, you know, certainly a lot of people have written books about Che, say, well, the Bolivians did it and the U.S. wasn't involved. What's your thought about that?
Well, the two main rangers, Fernandez and Gutierrez, were Americans. Well, that is, they were Cuban exiles in the CIA, trained as such, and then...
And they were with Che at the time, right, when he was killed?
Yeah. And they were put into the Ranger Battalion... But they were CIA operants, right? And one of them ended up being in Salvador, at the base in Salvador.
Yeah, Fernandez is famous, actually. That's right. Fernandez. He had a hair of Che in his wallet, supposedly, and the watch and some other things. Because a lot of our listeners probably don't recall, but Che was captured in Bolivia, and then he was taken to what the town is, Higuera?
Right, Higuera.
Higuera. Yeah. And then...
He was captured by Bolivian rangers, and they happened to... He was wounded, and he was shot in such a way that he dropped his rifle and couldn't pick it up in time. So he was unarmed, or he would have kept firing until they killed him. But, so they brought him to Higuera and waited for their commander said, you have to wait until the commanders get here, or the CIA gets here. They didn't, obviously never said CIA, but whatever it was, they waited for Fernandez and Gutierrez to get there. And one of them... Then Che supposedly, according to, I forgot her name, she Costa Gava's wife, who was the Italian correspondent that was there. According to her, she was told by one of the soldiers that Che provoked He says, you don't even have the guts to kill me face to face. And either Fernandez or Gutierrez, one of the two, took out his pistol and shot him.
Wow. Well, very, very sad, terrible story. Yeah. So, Tito, I want to thank you again. I know you've been obviously an amazing person for a long time. And I want to remind people, at least of the books that I know, there's the Coming of the New International, Vence Ramos, which is the collected works of Che, and The Great Fear, which really talks about what happened in Latin America during the Alliance for Progress. And you also have the only authorized biography of?
Jean-Paul Sartre.
Right. We should spend a few hours sometime reminiscing about your stories. Well, thank you very
much.
Thanks, Tito. My pleasure.
Bye-bye, Tito.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.